Okay, colleagues, friends, can we make a start, please? Very warm welcome to all. My name's Lisa Gormley, and I work in the Centre for Women, Peace and Security of the London School of Economics. And it's my pleasure to introduce you to this event, Women's Human Rights and Access to Justice for Gender-Based Violence, a view from legal practice in the UK. And it's hosted by us at the Centre for Women, Peace and Security. Before I introduce our speakers, a few housekeeping things. Please, if you could silence your telephones. And anyone wishing to comment on the event using Twitter is invited to use the hashtag LSE4, which is on the screen there. The event is being recorded, and our speakers have very kindly given their permission for this recording to take place. So we're just letting you know that, and then a podcast will be posted on the Centre's website. So our three speakers will present for no longer than 15 minutes, and then there'll be an opportunity to have questions and discussions. We will finish no later than 8 p.m, at which point you're all very warmly invited to join us for a drink outside. A few words then from me on the context. Again, you're all very warmly welcomed here by the Centre for Women, Peace and Security, and thank you so much for coming to our event. Again, the title is Women, Human Rights and Access to Justice for Gender-Based Violence, a view from legal practice in the UK. And I'll just make a few reflections before I introduce our three very eminent speakers. We have a context of two issues. First of all, my colleagues Christine Chinkin and Zoe Gillard encouraged the planning of this event to promote a publication that I wrote last year for the International Commission of Jurists. And I shall just get it up on the screen. So this is a publication I wrote last year for the International Commission of Jurists. It's a legal practitioner's guide on women's access to justice for gender-based violence. And it's very accessibly written. It's not sort of deeply technical. It is accessible, and it looks at the international human rights law standards on women's access to justice, specifically for gender-based violence. Obviously, women have big problems accessing justice for many discrimination issues, but this is specifically for gender-based violence. It contains a detail of international human rights law drawn from international human rights law, such as the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, and most recently its General Recommendation 33 on women's access to justice, and then the regional standards from the Americas, Africa, and Europe. And within the practitioner's guide, there's discussions on the intersection of gender-based violence against women and torture. The question, are women vulnerable or are they targeted because of their identity as women? It also looks at transformative reparation for gender-based violence, which includes dealing with the root causes of violence, and traps, dead ends and obstacles to justice, and the solutions proposed by the human rights law framework. So, for example, protection orders. The reason why we went with this format of the event is because last summer I had a really interesting exchange with Karen about the Michael case, a case where a woman known to be at risk of lethal violence by a former partner did not receive life-saving police assistance. And having read the judgment, I saw very little mention of international human rights law standards. And Karen and I had an exchange, and she said that because of the dualist tradition in UK law in relation to international law, international human rights law does not apply in national courts unless it is directly incorporated by statute. So then in the Centre for Women, Peace and Security, we had an idea to have a speaker meeting looking at the current failures in UK law to ensure protection for women's access to justice for gender-based violence. And that brings me to the second context, is that we currently have an opportunity to advocate for that implementation of human rights standards in UK domestic law. There's a campaign for ratification of the Council of Europe Convention on Preventing and Combating Violence Against Women and Domestic Violence, which is known as the Istanbul Convention. And you'll see this is called IC Change, so Istanbul Convention, you know, acronym IC, and IC Change, which is very nice. So the campaign now seeks to persuade members of Parliament to participate in a vote on a private members bill proposed by Dr. Ailie Whiteford MP. Now, the vote is on the 16th of December, and that accounts really for the timing of this meeting. We're doing this partly as a support to the IC Change advocacy on this issue, and we really hope that all of you here will be able to reach out to your MPs and encourage them to participate in the voting on the private members bill. And we have a colleague from Istanbul Change here, Rachel Nye, who's at the front, wearing a lovely mustard-coloured jumper. You can't miss her. And she'll let us know how we can participate in that advocacy. I'll move now to our eminent speakers with thanks, not only for graciously coming and accepting our invitation and spending the evening with us, but also because of the case work that they do. All three are extremely eminent practitioners, and I know from experience that doing casework is extremely hard. Advocating for legal change for women is very difficult because the patriarchal system being as it is sort of enshrined in the law, the remedies that you need aren't there, and so you are having to be a very creative lawyer in creating new ways of change. But also that process of supporting women and girls who seek justice, it's not easy. It's beyond the professional services lawyers, and I really think it's public service of the bravest feminist kind. So a general thanks again to our speakers, and I'll just introduce them. So first of all, we'll hear from Harriet Wistrich, who's a solicitor working at Bernberg Pierce, specialising in cases holding the police and other state bodies to account for abuse of power. She's a founder member of Justice for Women, a feminist campaigning organisation that supports and advocates on behalf of women who have fought back against or killed violent male partners. Pragna Patel is the director of Southall Black Sisters and a founding member of Women Against Fundamentalism. She's written extensively on race, gender and religion. SBF is a non-profit all-Asian organisation based in West London. SBS was originally established in order to provide a focus for the struggle of Asian women in the fight against racism, but became increasingly involved in defending the human rights of Asian women who are victims of domestic violence and in campaigning against religious fundamentalisms. Karen Monaghan, QC, is a barrister at Matrix Chambers, where she practices principally in the fields of equality and discrimination law, human rights law and EU law. Her work spans the fields of employment law, civil actions, judicial review and inquests. From Chambers and Partners, the review of lawyers says she probably has the most comprehensive discrimination expertise across the bar. She's a no-nonsense creative thinker when it comes to pushing the boundaries in gender equality and discrimination against women. So all three of you are most welcome, and call on Pragna first.
Okay. Lovely. I'll go first.
You have the floor, Pragna. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lisa, for inviting me to speak today. It's an absolute pleasure to be joining this panel with Harriet and Karen, who really are leaders in their field, I think. I'm going to talk largely from an activist point of view, but I have to say that talking about women's rights, state accountability, and access to justice in these momentous and really scary political and economic climate seems a bit surreal to me. It is hard to comprehend, I think, the scale of the challenge that lies before us. Why? Because I think the environment we inhabit is not an enabling one. It is dominated by an overriding focus on the neoliberal objectives of deficit reduction, deregulation, and privatization on the one hand, and on the other, mobilization of nationalisms, racisms, misogyny, and religious authoritarianism. So how do we make sense of the government signing up to the Istanbul Convention, when at the same time it is dismantling the welfare state and threatening to repeal the Human Rights Act. The very tools that we need to assert fundamental rights and freedoms. Even before Brexit and the triumph of Trump, we were left furiously fighting to save what little gains we had made in the area of women and human rights. But now the task of safeguarding human rights, let alone building upon them, has become even more urgent and difficult, and I think the outcome even more uncertain. For some 38 years, Black and minority women, and as South All Black Sisters has focused predominantly on South Asian women, but we actually work for all Black and minority women. But for some 38 years, minority women of all religious backgrounds have come to our center, recounting stories of violence, duress, intimidation, marital captivity, slavery, imprisonment, and neglect, from which they seek protection and legal redress. And it is in this context of inequality and powerlessness that the question of access to justice takes on significance for this group of women. So we know that one of the key advances made in human rights law in holding states to account for violence against women committed by non-state actors. One of the key advances made in human rights law is holding states to account for violence against women committed by non-state actors. So women around the world have struggled to ensure that certain forms of gender-based violence are criminalized and that the state takes responsibility for infringements of rights committed by non-state actors, by enacting laws and policies and programs that deal with both survivors and violators. Both CEDAW and the newly created Istanbul Convention, amongst other human rights conventions and mechanisms, are vital tools in this respect, and both clearly mark significant progress towards state accountability. The Istanbul Convention, for example, when ratified, will compel the UK government to provide, amongst other things, a robust criminal justice response, support services such as helplines, shelters, counselling services, medical care, and legal aid, as well as remove other structural impediments facing women who have suffered rape or other forms of violence. So on paper, all of this looks pretty good. But how do we make the promise become the reality? Our casework experience shows that the government's ability to ensure that there is effective protection and effective prevention and investigation of human rights abuses is seriously compromised by a range of austerity measures leading to cuts to legal aid and the decimation of welfare and specialist services. But it's also compromised by contradictory laws and social policy approaches and state imperatives. Other state imperatives, such as the introduction of draconian immigration laws and so on. In fact, immigration laws and policies on the ground are transforming frontline services that have a safeguarding remit, and they're transforming them into border agents. And that is seriously undermining the protection principle in domestic violence cases. And we've seen these in our local MARAP meetings, where the concern is in where immigration is seen as a safeguarding solution, controlling immigration, reporting those with illegal or insecure status to Home Office, whether they be perpetrators or victims. So this is an area of major challenge for us. And of course, needless to say, this is an area that has been particularly detrimental to Black and minority women's struggles for access to justice. I suppose it will be interesting to see how we'll be able to use the Istanbul Convention, in particular to augment the legal challenges that have already been made by us and by other women's groups to say cuts in legal aid and to specialist Black and minority women's services using equalities legislation. I don't really have time to go into details on the many areas of concern that we have, so I'm going to actually focus on two emerging areas that I think represent some of the most pressing challenges that we face. A key area of concern in relation to the gap in protection and the remedies available is one where violence against women occurs in transnational spaces. I'm actually talking about contexts in which perpetrators deliberately take women abroad to perpetrate violence in order to avoid detection in the UK. This is something that is emerging, largely as globalization processes of migration and marriage overlap. Our experience so far is that cross-jurisdictional nature of transnational violence against women allows not only perpetrators, but actually states to evade accountability. It is an area that will have that I think we will increasingly have to invoke human rights laws and standards and find ways of making them reflect the social reality that I'm talking about. So let me give you an example because it's the best way to illustrate what I'm talking about. It's regarding a current case that we're dealing with at the moment. On 31st March 2015, whilst on a family trip to India, Sita Kaur, a 34-year-old British national of Indian origin and the mother of four young children, died suddenly in highly suspicious circumstances at the home of her husband and in-laws. Her husband claimed that she died of a sudden heart attack. She's 34, had no prior health problems and conditions. Evidence that we've uncovered strongly suggests that she was a victim of honour killing, planned in the UK and executed in India. She suffered years of domestic violence for refusing her husband's persistent demands to allow one of her two sons to be adopted by her husband's brother-in-law and sister-in-law who live in India and who wanted a male heir. And it would appear that her husband was willing to go to any lengths to fulfil his promise and maintain his honour. The case actually has many parallels with the recent high-profile case of Samia Shahid. This was the Bradford case of a British national woman of Pakistani origin who was lured to Pakistan and killed in the name of honour for divorcing her first husband and marrying her second husband against her family's wishes. Sita's devastated family have been shunted from pillar to post for over 18 months in their quest to find justice. Both the Indian and the British authorities have failed to investigate her death. The Indian police, unsurprisingly, have failed abysmally in their duty to investigate her death as a crime of honour, possibly. But even in the UK, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and the Metropolitan Police, which is the area that's appropriate in her case, claim that they have no role to play in the investigation of Sita's death. Despite the fact that this is a potential honour killing of a British national, and despite the fact that honour-based violence has been designated high priority area by the government and the police. We are arguing that this failure on the part of the British state constitutes a flagrant disregard for the human rights of BME women. For example, we argue that there's a breach of Sita Kaur's right to life protected by Article 2 of the EHRC and a right to be free from inhuman and degrading treatment protected by Article 3 of the EHRC. We argue that the Met Police is under a positive obligation to initiate an effective investigation into these matters. And given the extraterritorial nature of the offence of conspiracy to commit murder abroad, we argue that a cooperative approach between the Met Police and the Indian Police Service is necessary if the Met Police is to discharge its Article 2 and Article 3 obligations. The failure to recognise the transnational nature of honour crimes could also arguably amount to indirect discrimination against British women of South Asian and perhaps Middle Eastern and other minority origins, since they're more likely to be killed abroad. And it could amount to a breach of the public sector equality duty under the Equality Act 2010. So it'll be interesting as we continue with this particular campaign that we're about to launch to see what other human rights laws and mechanisms we can draw upon in terms of seeking state accountability. Our actual demand is that the state needs to take serious stock of the public-private divide that is clearly evident in police policy and practice in relation to transnational forms of violence. The law in this area is ambiguous at best, and there are no effective remedies. It would seem that if an honour killing takes place abroad, even if it involves a British national, it is treated as a private family matter. And this, in our view, amounts to state complicity because it grants impunity to the perpetrators of violence who know that they can escape detection by taking women abroad. So that's one area that I think is going to be an emerging area, looking at ways in which women whose rights are violated in transnational spaces and who takes responsibility for those violations. The other area, perhaps, in fact, more than anything else, there is one area that is currently giving us immense cause for concern in respect of state accountability, and that is the increasing accommodation of minority religious systems of arbitration in family matters. The vacuum created by the state's abrogation of its key welfare and legal obligations and its attempts to privatize justice and promote faith-based frameworks for minorities has led to the rise and accommodation of minority religious codes in the law itself. This includes the acceptance of religious-based alternative dispute resolution forums such as Sharia councils and Muslim arbitration forums. They've been set up in the name of religious freedom, but in reality, the ultimate political and legal goal of those who set them up is to remove women's rights from the shadow of the law by taking control of family matters in minority communities. And as we all know, the family is a site of considerable inequality, imbalance, and imbalance of power. It is arguably the place where vulnerable minority women are at greatest risk of violence, oppression, and injustice. But it is also the site most susceptible to cultural relativism and the processes of privatization. So the convergence of dominant illiberal forms of fundamentalist strands of religion and the law is particularly devastating for minority women because they face the full brunt of highly discriminatory and patriarchal religious codes of conduct. Religious arbitration bodies deny women their rights in all aspects of family matters and actually entrench gender inequality. And this is true for all women around the world. Women and children do not have legal representation during the process of religious arbitration. Decisions are not public material. There is no right of appeal, nor is there any evidence of any meaningful commitment to the key principles of the rule of law: accessibility, transparency, impartiality, confidentiality, certainty, procedural fairness, the absence of discretion, and compliance with international human rights obligations. Indeed, because religious forums operate on the basis of so-called divine law, they are by their very nature not amenable to state scrutiny and accountability. So we're now seeing the blurring of the law and religion, the lines between the law and religion. And I actually think that we must treat this with great caution, since it ultimately contributes to the view that secular human rights principles are not applicable to minority cultures, and that minority women are subjects of their religious communities and not equal citizens. Just to give an example, the Istanbul Convention and CEDAW explicitly forbids the use of alternative dispute resolutions as a method of addressing criminal responsibility for domestic violence. Yet current practices show that these religious forums are sabotaging criminal proceedings. The Muslim Arbitration Tribunal, and you can see this if you go to their website, actively involves itself in criminal proceedings on domestic violence, despite stating that it is unable to deal with criminal offences. It uses its position of power to persuade the CPS to drop charges and to encourage women to reconcile with abusive partners without reference to court orders that may have been obtained, without reference to risk assessments or safety planning or good practice that has been developed by feminist legal advocacy. And this is really worrying. So it'll be, I've seen some of the guidance that's available in terms of, in the practitioner's guide by the International Commission, produced by the International Commission of Jurists. And I think that some of the guidance in there in relation to international human rights law and alternative systems of mediation and arbitration family matters is going to be key for us to draw on. For example, the guidance refers to a UN Women report in 2011 that said non-state justice systems and plural formal laws based on specific interpretations of religion or ethnic identity can contain provisions that discriminate against women. It also says that they tend to reflect the interests of the powerful who have a greater say in shaping and defining laws and values, and that the practical complexity of legal pluralism can create barriers for women's access to justice by enabling the powerful and the rich to forum shop to gain legal advantage. And I noticed that the Istanbul Convention also refers to the prohibition of mandatory alternative dispute resolution processes. But actually, it has nothing to say where women refer to these forums out of sheer weight of social expectations and compulsion. And what may appear voluntary is often not voluntary. So the UN Women's Report is going to be useful again because it also recognizes that the state's responsibility for ensuring compliance with human rights standards extends to all justice practices, including alternative dispute resolution methods. So I think we have a situation where we have to challenge the state's accommodation of legal pluralism. The state is implicated. It cannot abrogate its responsibility for ensuring compliance with human rights standards by creating and validating private spaces to be governed by religious arbitration systems that operate outside the law. That is why focusing on internal reform or some kind of light regulation as an answer to this problem is a dangerous option, and it's being put about quite a bit, including, I think that, and I think that's where the current inquiries on Sharia laws is going to go, that they're going to suggest some kind of light regulation and internal reform. But quite apart from the fact that it is simply not economically viable, how is a state going to regulate yet another system of so-called justice when it can't even regulate its own? But quite apart from the fact that economically it's not viable, we actually are going to see that there will be no political will to hold such arbitrary forums to account. So these are really testing times. I actually think it's difficult to continue with business as usual when all that we see around us is kind of moral and political decay. How do we stand together and face up to the reactionary populist forces that are sweeping to power on a democratic mandate, when the sole objective of that mandate is to dismantle the very principles of democracy, the rule of law, and human rights? So, but I guess plod on we must. I guess the very challenges will also motivate us to redouble our efforts to defend and build on what we have gained in advancing the cause of human rights, both in and outside the law.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Pragna. And one thing that really struck me is that the question of extraterritorial jurisdiction is one of the real sticking points with this double convention ratification. They don't want to do it. And it's wonderful that we've heard what you had to say about how important it is. So, Harriet, please, the floor is yours.
I tried to do a PowerPoint, so I'll just see if I can get it up here. Let's just press something. Sorry, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, just bring it up there. Okay, brilliant. Thank you. I can just get out there. Yeah. Okay. Great.
Yeah. So, can I just also commend this brilliant publication? Actually, I hadn't known about the centre before, and when I got invited to speak, Lisa forwarded this publication. I think it's incredibly comprehensive and helpful, and a very useful resource. So, really interesting to see that. I'm going to just focus on one area of largely gender-based violence, which is rape. and sexual assault. And really, to what I'm going to do is just talk a little bit about using some cases that I've brought to kind of illustrate the difficulties that we face in relation to rape victims getting justice in our jurisdiction. It has been said that there is a degree of impunity for rapists because of the extent to which there is a failure to secure justice for rape victims. There has been a lot of efforts to improve the position by bringing in laws and guidance, but there is still a huge sort of disjunct between what we see on paper and what we see in practice. There's been some quite a bit of research about attrition. And attrition is the process whereby rape cases drop out of the legal process. Before we even start with reported rapes, we know that many women don't ever report rape. Of those cases that are actually reported, the various research that's been conducted says somewhere between about 5 to 7% of reported rapes end up in conviction. So that's a huge dropout rate. And the rates are worse for certain categories of victim. Younger women, and in particular, really, really scary statistics and evidence around those with mental illness and learning disability. One report, for example, by Marianne Hester, followed 87 rape cases, I think, in the Northeast. And she found that none of those 87 cases that involved mental health issues made it to the court stage. The extent of attrition, this is some research by Betsy Stanko, who worked for a period of time with the Metropolitan Police. She presented some of her research here a couple of years ago. And she found of the big sample, that was quite an extensive piece of research, that only 7% of allegations were police no crimed. 40% ended with a police decision to take no further action. Of the remaining allegations, 30% dropped out through a CPS decision to take no further action rather than prosecute to court. So that's the sort of statistical framework. And then what I want to just talk about was a few cases, some of which are cases that I was involved in, which look at the different stages and just sort of give you some examples, really, of where and how these dropout rates take place. Now, the case DSD, which Karen will talk a bit more about, is quite an important case relating to the Article 3 duty to investigate rape, and it concerned the notorious taxi driver rapist John Warboys, who over a period of a number of years was found to have committed approximately over 100 rapes and sexual assaults by drugging women in the back of his black cab. Over this period, there were found to have been about 10 to 12 women who came forward to claim. Now, drug-assisted rape is a particularly problematic area because, of course, the victim doesn't remember exactly what happened, so already there's a credibility problem. And also her behaviour, and particularly if one of the other areas where attrition's very high is where somebody has been drunk. He particularly targeted women outside nightclubs late at night, so the chances were that they would have had a few drinks as well. And two of the women who came forward to make complaints, one was DSD and one was MBV, were both disbelieved. Well, the police dropped their cases very early on, and it was only really after, I think, about the 10th case came to the police that they suddenly started noticing a very, very similar pattern of evidence, which eventually led to his arrest and conviction. I won't go into any more detail, but it's an important case, and it did kind of establish this duty to investigate in cases where a third party actor violates Article 3. At the same time that was going on, we had Kurt Reed, who also was acting in South East London, I think, and was found to have raped and sexually assaulted more than 71 women. Now, can I say this was the Sapphire Unit of the Metropolitan Police, which was held up as this great new unit, sort of gold standard rape investigation unit. And again, they just kind of failed to pick up this pattern. The third case I mentioned, which you probably haven't heard of, hasn't had so much publicity, is based up in the Northwest, as a man called Patrick Hall. And this came to me, I'll mention it a little bit later, through an inquest, sadly, of one of the victims of Patrick Hall. She was, I think, the fourth of seven women who reported rape by this man, who obviously targeted very vulnerable, drug-using, mental health problematic women. And she was the fourth victim, and like the three before her, went to report this rape, and the police dropped the charges, didn't feel that there was a chance of conviction. And it was only after a fifth woman came forward that suddenly again, I thought, actually, it does look like there's a bit of a pattern. He was arrested on all four previous occasions and said it was consensual. And it was only on the fifth one. And I'll come back to that case in very shortly as to what happened at trial. The other place where we see a dropout, and I think in Betsy's research it was something like 40% dropout of police decisions of charging. This is I just put in a quote because it was a case that I've just been looking at now, which I've just kind of worked, my mouth dropped open when I read the police justification in a victim's right of review. It was a case of a woman who'd alleged rape by her. Mother's cousin, who was twice her age, a family member. She was actually a lesbian and in a relationship, and had forgotten what had happened. And the next day, and the police said, "Well, you don't actually remember what happened, therefore." And he says that you consented and you had sex over a period of hours, and therefore, you know, there's no, because you don't remember, you haven't confirmed that you didn't consent. We're challenging that decision at the moment, but this is, you know the sort of range of decisions that are made even without referral to the Crown Prosecution Service for a decision. The other stage is in relation to the Crown Prosecution Service, and I've just again, this is, I've sort of illustrated this just because it's some cases that I've been involved with. This is an example which some might say is somewhat discriminatory. But the man on the left, in case you don't recognise him, is Mark Kennedy, who's an undercover police officer who had sexual relationships with women when he was impersonating being an activist, but he was actually an undercover police officer spying on them. And the woman on the right is Gail Newland, who was convicted and sentenced to 8 years in prison for allegedly impersonating, pretending to be a boy when actually she was a girl in a relationship. And there have been a number of convictions of women who've been impersonating men for rape and sexual assault. And yet when the police have looked at cases of undercover police officers impersonating activists, and in both situations the sexual relationship at the time was consensual, but subsequently the horror of realising that the person was somebody not only who you know, somebody who wasn't who they said they were, but somebody fundamentally opposite to what they believed in. I'm getting, was felt to be very, very violating, particularly in relation to the undercover officers, because they'd been sent in there by the state and resourced by the state and so on. And in one case which we did actually take, the woman did want to pursue to the CPS, CPS dismissed the case, and this is actually in relation to misconduct. They also dismissed it on rape and various other sexual offences, but in relation to misconduct, they said it's not automatically misconduct, and that the relationship was an entirely genuine one. And this militates against the finding that it was misconduct to the requisite degree. So, genuine from whose point of view, I don't know. But anyway. So it's just an example of some funny decision making, or very disturbing decision making. So what happens for those cases that actually get past the CPS charging rate and go to trial? Well, there are a number of issues which I think CPS have been trying to address about ensuring that victims have proper connection, properly informed during prepared for the trial process. We've had special measures introduced to give some protection to rape victims. There are issues still, though, about not having any interaction with the prosecution, and that if you go through, you're recommended not to have counselling because then that can be used against you. The time, and in fact, the woman on the left is Frances Andrade, who was a violinist who gave evidence in the Cheetham Hill case, I think, and she found it so traumatic being cross-examined that she committed suicide, very sadly. The woman on the right is Tracy Shelby. This is a woman I represented. Well, I didn't represent her. I represented her family request. In Oldham, and she was one of the fourth women who gave evidence against Patrick Hall, who I mentioned earlier. And he actually was tried for, I think, 6 rapes originally. The jury acquitted on some and were hung on 2 others, on 3 others. There was a retrial. She gave evidence at both trials. And at the end, and she had quite serious mental health and drug problems and all sorts. And after the end of the second trial, she was informed that he'd been acquitted of all charges. She threw herself off a shopping centre. It was a pretty awful case. There were sort of lots of issues about multi-agency failures that we were looking at, but it kind of shows the difficulties you have. And I also mentioned Section 41 of the Youth Justice and Criminal Evidence Act, which is the measure that was designed to try and stop cross-examination of women's previous sexual history. And I'm sure you've all read about the Ched Evans case and the potentially discouraging impact that has on women coming forward to give evidence. So that's the trial process. Oops, sorry, wrong way. and then in addition to the difficulties around the trial process, we also have other risks about reporting rape. We have the woman here is a woman called Eleanor De Freitas, who made a complaint of rape against a man who was very wealthy, and when the police decided not to pursue that, she also, by the way, had mental illness. He pursued a prosecution for perverting the course of justice, and she was hoping the CPS would drop the charges, but they pursued it, and she committed suicide just on the eve of the trial. The father spoke out at the inquest, and then he was sued for libel by the same man, and also subject to a horrific social media campaign, which you'll also have seen happened in relation to Ched Evans. So, and I, you know, there are a number of other cases of women who've made rape complaints where they haven't been believed, being sued for libel, and in one case, malicious prosecution, I think. So, and finally, just to end on a not a very cheery note, we have the, you might have read the Henricus report into Operation Midland investigation, where he says a major contributing factor was the culture that victims must be believed. Now, actually, this is something we fought really, really hard for, to try and assist with the police, you know, starting off from a starting point. You know, instead of the old let's drive a coach and horses through our evidence, let's start from believing the evidence, and then only until it kind of becomes totally incredible do we drop it. So that's a very worrying development, and what might come out of that report is also concerning. Sorry to remind you of the man on the bottom. I'm sure it hasn't escaped anyone's attention that we now have perhaps the most powerful man in the world, who has made all sorts of horrific comments about women and all sorts of other people, and has been accused of multiple sexual assaults, and is also probably wishing to dismantle every single international human rights convention if he knew what they were. So,
let's hope he doesn't find out.
Once he finds out, yeah. So, yes, on that cheery note, I shall.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Harriet. That was brilliant. So, Karen, you have the floor.
Thank you. Thank you, too, for inviting me. It's already been a really interesting evening, so I'm very pleased to be here. I'm going to make some observations about the international and regional human rights context. That's been touched upon to some degree already by Harriet and Pragna, but I'll make some other observations, in part to contextualise some of the case law, the domestic case law, that I'm going to speak about in one moment. So starting with the international law context, and picking up in a moment on something Lisa said in her introductory remarks. First of all, in relation to the international law context, there are obviously very important UN measures addressing gendered forms of violence. In the first place, they derive from the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, which itself requires states to address discrimination which has the effect or purpose of nullifying or impairing women's human rights and fundamental freedoms. It also imposes obligations on states to establish the legal protection of rights of women on an equal basis, including the rights of women to enjoy ordinary fundamental human rights, and to introduce effective protection for women against any act of discrimination. We know from the CEDAW committee, because of its most important recommendation addressing violence against women, recommendation number 19, we know that violence against women is treated by the CEDAW committee as discrimination itself, so that the obligation under CEDAW on states to introduce measures designed to address and protect women against discrimination requires them in particular to take measures addressing gendered forms of violence, domestic violence, sexual violence, and so on. That recommendation makes clear that the obligation extends, of course, to protective measures. It also extends to the need to provide reparations, compensation, where there's been a failure to protect a woman against gendered forms of violence. So there's an international framework requiring states to introduce measures directed at protecting women against gendered forms of violence, and to introduce a scheme for affording women who have been subject to it compensation or other remedies, including access to justice in respect of state failures. We also know from the General Assembly declaration on the elimination of violence against women, promulgated as long ago as 1993, that there is, as a matter of international law, a due diligence obligation on states. That is an obligation to exercise due diligence to prevent, investigate and punish acts of violence against women. So a due diligence obligation on the state. And case law, or individual complaints, petitions as they're described, in the context of complaints under CEDAW to the committee, make clear that that due diligence obligation is a robust one. That's all right. Were you asking me something?
No.
Is a robust one. So a robust obligation in international law deriving from UN Declaration, CEDAW, and from the determination of individual complaints, that it's an obligation protective, investigative, and an obligation to provide remedies where there's been a breach. We know at the Council of Europe level about the Istanbul Convention, signed but not ratified, as we know, again imposing protective and investigative obligations on the state and a duty to introduce remedies, reparations, where there has been violence against women. And importantly, because we have ratified it, we are members of the Council of Europe, the convention itself, the European Convention on Human Rights, imposes, again, significant obligations on states to investigate gendered forms of violence and to protect women against specific risks. The most important recent case addressing the scope of those obligations is Opus and Turkey, which will be well known to many of you, I'm sure. The Grand Chamber in Opus made clear that domestic violence, which was an issue in that case, is a gendered form of violence. It may seem very obvious, but we did need the Grand Chamber to state that in terms. So a gendered form of violence, the protective obligations in Article 2 and the investigative obligations in Article 2 and 3 are triggered in the case of gendered forms of violence, and Article 14 as well. So the Grand Chamber recognised gendered forms of violence as triggering the state's investigative and protective obligations, and that a failure to comply with those obligations was itself discriminatory. So a very important case. It was an exceptionally serious case. Turkey failed over years to address acts of very serious domestic violence, resulting ultimately in the shooting of the complainant's mother. But as I say, very important in identifying gendered forms of violence, of triggering of protective and investigative obligations and failures constituting a violation of Article 14. So very important indeed. As to domestic case law, then, that being the context, well, first of all, so far as domestic case law is concerned, we know, of course, that the Human Rights Act, broadly speaking, gives effect to the Convention. There are tweaks, and I'll come to that in a moment. But broadly speaking, gives a domestic effect to the Convention. As Lisa touched upon in her opening observations, the international law obligations imposed on the state are not directly effective in domestic law because we have a dualist rather than a monist system, which means that the state's obligations under international conventions do not automatically become part of domestic law. There has to be some specific implementing measure. However, having said that, that doesn't mean they are of no effect domestically insofar as legal enforcement is concerned, because there is a very great deal of case law that makes clear that the state's obligations in international law are to be had regard to, firstly, in the development of the common law, secondly, in construing legislation, on the basis that the state is to be taken as not legislating contrary to, in a way which is contrary to its international law obligations, save where Parliament has said so pretty explicitly. And thirdly, of course, it's important because it runs through all the Strasbourg jurisprudence under the Convention, which is then had regard to domestically in giving effect to the Human Rights Act, rights and freedoms under the Human Rights Act. So it has importance, notwithstanding the fact that specific implementing measures haven't been introduced in respect of CEDAW, for example. I mean, there are measures which have the effect of implementing aspects of CEDAW, but there's no specific implementing measure. So that's the context. They do have force. Notwithstanding that, regrettably, but perhaps unsurprisingly, our domestic courts haven't been uniformly progressive in giving effect to those rights, both at international and those rights that exist at international and regional level. So case law under the Convention and at common law haven't always taken a particularly sensitive approach to the addressing of gendered forms of violence and state failures in particular. But one which did produce a positive result is the one that's already been alluded to by Harriet, and that was Harriet's case DSD, the War Boys case, the taxi driver case. In that case, Harriet and her legal team argued that there was a positive obligation under Article 3, that is, prohibition on inhuman and degrading treatment, a positive obligation on the state under Article 3 to investigate criminal activity which reached the high threshold of Article 3, which plainly rape does, so a duty to investigate rape. The police said, no, no, there's no obligation to investigate, there's no investigative obligation under Article 3 because Article 1 of the Convention hasn't been given effect to under the Convention. Article 1 of the Convention says a state must give effect to the obligations under Article, under all the other articles, including Article 3, and since that hadn't been introduced under the Human Rights Act, there was no obligation for the state to give effect to any subsidiary investigative obligation under Article 3. Fortunately, the case, the court said, that's a load of rubbish, and there was such an investigative obligation, and it was breached. So a positive outcome. It was, I think, a case where the facts were so extraordinary and the failures so horrendous that, frankly, it would have been pretty appalling not to have constructed some positive obligation to investigate under Article 3. But there we are. It was the court did hold such an obligation existed, and that was good. Not all cases, regrettably, have been so progressive. One that I was referred to, again, I think, by Lisa in her opening remarks, Michael. So police failures to respond properly to a 999 call by a woman who said her partner was coming to kill her, he was threatening to kill her. The operator didn't communicate that threat to kill in seeking to dispatch a police car at the earliest opportunity, so it wasn't given a sufficiently high rating. The woman rang 999 again, but by which time he was in the house and he killed her while indeed she was on the phone to the police. So there was a claim of negligence at common law. As many of you may know, there is a rule at common law in negligence that the police are immune under the law of negligence in respect of any failures made in when exercising any operational functions. So investigation, protection, matters of that sort all fall outside the duty of negligence because of a rule that's developed at common law. We argued in the Supreme Court
common law has to be completely revisited on the basis that there's otherwise a failure to give effect to the international due diligence obligations imposed on the state. There was a discussion about those obligations at international law, but a very brief one by the majority, resulting, I think, in one line that said, yes, well, that's all very interesting, but international law doesn't tell us how we should have to give effect to those, and we've decided that the law of negligence isn't one of the means by which the state must give effect to these obligations. And so there was a fairly compelling dissenting judgment by, guess who, Baroness Hale, but the majority concluded that the law of negligence didn't need to be revisited in the light of those international law obligations. So extremely concerning. Interestingly, the Supreme Court have just given leave to review that immunity within about 15, 18 months of the decision in Michael. So I think they realised they left
in another case.
In another case. I'll tell you what that is if you're interested. It's actually an old lady who was hit by a policeman when he was chasing a perpetrator. But the Supreme Court like old ladies, and they're pretty tolerant of disabled people because they can see themselves and their family within that. No, I'm serious, I think. But I think they've struggled to empathise with women victims of domestic violence, is my perception. Don't report me on that. I'll probably be disbarred or something. And just very briefly, I know I'm running out of time, another case, and I think was very problematic, was the bedroom tax case this week. A number of disabled people involved in that case, but more particularly a case I was involved in, which also went with those cases, regrettably heard at the same time a point that Baroness Hale made, because I don't think it was given sufficient attention. Again, Baroness Hale unsurprisingly dissented, but a woman who is at very, very high risk of death in consequence of domestic violence, so lives in a very secure home, spotlights, searchlights, panic alarm, safe room, reinforced steel doors, external post box, you name it, has been told by the council she's over-occupying and so she must leave. We argued that an exception should be made because of the scheme she's in, which is a very specific scheme, the sanctuary scheme, just as it is made in certain contexts for disabled people. And the Supreme Court said no. And in a bizarrely contradictory judgment, because they also said for so long as her life is at risk, that is, so long as she's in this scheme, she can't be evicted from her home. So they've produced this bizarre position, which, as Baroness Hale said, is pretty inexplicable and difficult to work out why they would fail to direct an exemption in the circumstances of her case while doing so in the case of various disabled people who are required to stay in their homes. But there we are. So we don't have, regrettably, a consistently positive picture. And although the Equality Act has been mentioned, I don't have time to say anything about it, but it is an inadequate model for addressing serious gendered forms of violence for various reasons.
I could have listened to all three of you all night, so I was very sorry to be passing the 5-minute notes. But we do have to we do have to open the floor for questions, and we do have to go and have our drink. So please, if there are any questions, please, now's the moment. Yes, Rachel. Oh, yes, and please introduce yourself and state your name and your affiliation.
My name's Rachel. I'm from the IT Change campaign. Lots to be worried about. I'm desperately trying to find positive things. So it's really, really inspiring to sort of see you all and the work you're doing, and it sort of makes you think, I can keep going a bit longer and just, keep fighting and kicking. The IC Change campaign, campaign to get the Istanbul Convention ratified, IC sort of stands for the Istanbul Convention, but when choosing the name, we were also thinking about the things that we see in the convention, and what do you see? So I guess that's my question: what do you see in the convention that can give us a bit of hope? Because we really, really need it. I need it.
The Istanbul Convention.
Yeah.
Maybe we can take some more questions, and then we'll all think about that one. Nathan.
Hi, my name's Nathan Sparling, and I'm actually involved in writing the bill that will come up to Parliament on the 16th of December. And one of the issues that is causing the most problem is extraterritorial jurisdiction. The Ministry of Justice seem to be continually dragging their feet on this, which the government have claimed is the single thing that's stopping them from ratifying. Now, the Ministry of Justice claim that it is only a measure which needs tackling in England and Wales, and I just wondered if anyone had any thoughts on what an approach to tackling this issue might look like in legislation.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay, if I may, can I start on the Istanbul Convention about what's good about it? I think, okay, there's a few things I like in it. Basically, Article 7 requires coordinated policies. It requires, under Article 10, a coordinating body within the government to organise it. So across not just Home Office, but also Justice, Housing, you know, Social Security, health, importantly, and also one of the things I like the best is Article 14, which is about education of children from the earliest age with age-appropriate information about gender equality, violence against women, not, peaceful methods of resolving conflict. And the other thing I like very much, particularly when I read Professor Sylvia Wolby's work, is the issue about data gathering, which is Article 11. There's loads more I can say about things I like in the Istanbul Convention. There's tons of things. So risk assessment in Article 51, including a lethality risk and including whether or not a perpetrator has access to firearms. And I think if that's done seriously, we could be saving some lives very quickly. Any thoughts from the panel about other things you like?
Well, the one area that I mentioned that I think is particularly important for is invoking the obligations in relation to provision of services, because I think that if those services are not there and that welfare net, safety net's not there, then it doesn't really matter if you have these laws. So I think that the two have to go hand in hand. Actually, I think the whole resources question has kind of really, really taken a back seat because people have just accepted austerity. So I think that, you know, being able to invoke that particular, those provisions is going to be interesting, how we advocate using that. The other thing is not so much the provisions, which of course are progressive, but I actually think that, and you know, Harriet's, and I mentioned it, and Harriet mentioned it, I mean, you know, Trump is not Trump, it's what we're seeing across the globe in terms of that kind of regressive populism, which is turning its back, I think, on human rights values and standards. So my one positive thing about part of the campaign around the convention, the Istanbul Convention, is actually trying to stop you know, the powers that be shifting the ethical basis of law and standards and values. And I think more than ever, as feminists, activists, lawyers, we need to embed that kind of human rights culture at multiple levels, both in the law, but also culturally, politically, and in all the spaces that we can find. So I feel that that provides yet another way in which we can try and consolidate or build that kind of language, which I think, you know, is probably more important now than ever.
My favourite is the due diligence obligation, but that's because I'm so fed up with the Supreme Court. I think if we had it in terms in a ratified regional human rights instrument,
Christine
it may...
that.
Oh, did you? Thank you, Christine. But I like it even more now. I think it's, you know, it really needs to be headlined. There is a due diligence obligation. So that would be my favourite.
Did they?
Yeah. Well, they didn't like it because it's meaningful.
Yeah, precisely.
any more?
Oh, yes, sorry, you said how do we draft, did you ask for a drafting tip?
If you want to draft it,
I would repeat Article 44 and let the courts deal with it. A bit like Article 1 under the Convention.
Okay. Article 44?
Extraterritorial jurisdiction. Yeah.
Interesting. Any more questions? Yes.
Oh, thank you. My name's Lotta Teal. I work with Open Society Foundations. I don't work in the UK or on the UK at all, so I cannot speak to the experiences we've been talking about this evening. But I would be interested, in light of the shift towards ADR and the use of Islamic law in the UK. I work a lot in Pakistan. I used to work a lot in Sierra Leone. I understand that from the position that we're currently in, using the formal law in the UK, it's quite problematic to go in the direction that we're going in. But we're always grappling. I work a lot in rural areas, working on access to justice for women. And it's a real struggle when the justice, and I don't know if the three of you or the four of you have experience in working in these sorts of contexts, but it is a real struggle when you're working in a place where the formal system does not work effectively, certainly is not working for women, where the police system is not working, and where the customary justice system does have a degree of operating, is in some situations protective with some individuals, protective is in some many individuals, it's pretty abusive. Certainly in Pakistan, there are significant worries about working with a customary justice system at all. And I would just be interested in your reflections on that in contexts like that, and how, you know, practically how one can try and grapple with those things if you've had that experience. Thank you.
The person in front in the Davis top.
Hi, I'm from University of California, Davis, currently studying abroad here at the LSE, and Fred Williams. My question is, what kind of things is the international community doing to combat honor killings within certain religious sectors, and is there something in place to, like, be a refuge for those who feel like they could be a victim for those or have the possibility? That was my question. Yeah.
Great. Two great questions for you, Pragna.
I know. On what's the international community doing on honour killings? I think there's quite a lot being done at the international level, including in the Istanbul Convention itself. I think it specifically mentions, I can't remember the
gender-based persecution.
Yeah. But it actually mentions honour killings. So actually, I think it's on the international human rights agenda. But I think the problem is where there is conflicts of laws. And that's where, you know, and the question of what trumps sort of whether formal laws should trump kind of customary traditions and religious values.
I don't think we're allowed to use the word trump anymore, but
sorry.
It's an ambiguity.
So, you know, whether that takes precedence. So I think that is a major political and legal battle that's probably taking place. And that also comes back to the other question that you were raising about, you know, different contexts, and can you use more community-based forms of justice where the formal legal system itself is inadequate? And I can see that that can be a real dilemma. But I think in countries like Pakistan, actually, or Afghanistan even, and India, where these parallel legal systems have operated, they have always operated. They're quite patriarchal structures. They're presided over by village elders who are male and who have a vested political interest in maintaining patriarchy. And so we've seen that in those structures, when women engage in those structures, they really, it's to their detriment. If we look at, for example, rape cases, if we look at, what these forums have dictated in terms of women who allege rape, often they're paraded naked around the village and subject to flogging and accused of, in Pakistan's situation, zina, which is adultery, because they can't prove that they were raped, and they can't produce the witnesses. That was under the old Zina adultery laws of Pakistan. And actually, what we're seeing in those countries, it's not quite right to say that, you know, these justice systems are kind of operating and what do you do when an imperfect legal, a formal legal system exists. Because actually what we're seeing are real women's struggles going on mm-hmm. to improve the formal legal system. And in Pakistan at the moment, what we see is, despite the existence of parallel legal systems, we see women struggling for their rights and seeking protection from the formal legal system. At the moment, at this very moment, there is a struggle going on to introduce a domestic violence bill in Pakistan. Who is it being resisted by? The powers, the village powers, and the so-called panchayats and the jurgas and, you know, the kind of village justice systems. They have come together and are lobbying really hard to prevent that domestic violence bill from being introduced. So that shows you that, yes, those parallel legal systems exist. They don't necessarily provide justice. They don't listen to women. Women are not equal actors in those systems. And they're trying to make the legal system that exists more perfect. And that's true for us here too. One of the reasons why the accommodation of religious codes in the legal system and the accommodation of parallel legal systems here is so alarming is because actually black and minority women, along with other women, have struggled so hard to make the state system accountable. And despite the limitations and the setbacks at the Supreme Court and at the CPS level and the charging level and whatever, we have achieved so much. We have shifted the ways in which institutional, you know, responses have discriminated against women. And yet we now seem to be sort of stepping back from that as if these other systems are going to be better alternatives. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is, if I was honest, I would say around the world, there is now probably the most urgent struggle that's going on is the struggle to keep religion and the law separate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that is such an important struggle if we call ourselves progressives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Karen?
Yeah, I just wanted really to pick up on that point as well, because I don't know anything about the situation in the countries that you were talking about, but certainly here I think we really need to be really worried about it, because there is an increasing accommodation, a creeping accommodation. So some work I was involved with Pravna, the Law Society. I mean, the Law Society, the regulatory body for lawyers, issued guidance to solicitors as to how they can draft Sharia-compliant law wills. Now, what is the Law Society, a state regulatory body, doing, telling solicitors this is what you do to ensure that these wills are Sharia compliance? And we are also hearing discussions within legal fora about the fact that there are inadequacies within the state justice system. Yes. So the sorts of discussion, I know the context you're talking about is very different, but nevertheless, that narrative, well, there are inadequacies in the domestic justice system. There's a shortage of money. It can take a long time to get to court. We're having serious discussions about that, that being the theme, and therefore religious arbitral systems can be very positive. They can be really great for women because they can provide justice at an early stage and so on. Not, we need to be fighting to make sure the justice system is operating properly. We need to make sure courts aren't closing. We need to make sure an adequate number of judges are being appointed. But instead, well, things don't work so very well, so that's a good reason for us to have these courts. Mm-hmm. And there are, you know, there are these people are coming out that are being listened to, saying things like that. Mm-hmm. And I really think we need to be really keep our eye on that, because it's, I think, really creeping into the sort of mainstream discourse amongst certain parts of the legal community, which I think is very, very worrying. And it's sort of the sense is it's a progressive cultural accommodation. It's not. It's very, very worrying, I think.
Any last questions? Yes.
Hi, my name's Colleen. I'm also from the University of California, Davis. And my question, so does the Istanbul Convention have any sort of framework to like hold states accountable once they ratify it? So you mentioned a previous Supreme Court case was like, oh, that's all, that's very nice and all, but the international law doesn't tell us how to implement that. So like, it doesn't matter. So what makes the Istanbul Convention any different than any previous international conventions?
Well, first of all, I think there is a move to actually implement it domestically, so to introduce domestic laws to give effect to it. So in other words, we won't have that problem. We will be looking at domestic law rather than international law. And secondly, it forms part of the Council of Europe structure, which is a regional-based mechanism. And at least through the European Convention, the European Court has a where the European Court has jurisdiction to determine questions, we'll get some indirect implementation through that route. But yes, I think we all need to be ensuring that there is specific domestic implementing legislation. So as to avoid those difficulties.
How are we going to ensure that?
If I can add on that one, there's a monitoring body. So every country that signs up to the Istanbul Convention agrees to participate in a monitoring process. So every, say, 4 years or so, they fill in a report, travel to Strasbourg, present it to the committee, and then they have what's called a process of constructive dialogue where the experts on the committee say, OK, well, this has been done well, but this is not so good. They're entitled to receive communications from non-governmental organisations like South or Black Sisters, where, you know, if non-governmental organisations got concerns about the way it's operating, then they can raise that with the committee. And then the committee will basically give the state a list of things to do and improve. And then a couple of years later, the process will happen again. So the people on this committee are extremely eminent expert people. I mean, they're very impressive people. And, you know, already they're building up a kind of body of knowledge about things like data collection. So what works for data collection, what works for judicial training, what works for education, what works for engaging with the media. So it's a very substantive discussion. Right, any other questions? Right, so it just remains for me to thank our speakers again very, very sincerely for coming. And I've also got a few other thanks to Christine Chinkin and Zoe Gillard for encouraging me to do this, to Yale Nevo and Kelsey Kamitomo for helping out with the stewarding and the welcoming and the computer, and also to Rachel Nye from the IC Change campaign for coming and being with us. So again, thanks to the speakers very sincerely. Great. So please, you're